What we, the economists, call the ZPG, zero population growth, is not the same as the growth rate in the birth and death rate being balanced. It is comes 45 years later. So we have a long, long way to go. Many other countries, Germany and other countries, have already achieved that. A zero, their population is stable. There some countries' population is going down actually. In India, as you know, of course, the Parsi community, the population is going down. But there are other various other factors for that. But in India, for
now, several issues have been raised in response to your question. And I am glad that this whole question, of various facets of this question of privatization, have been brought up and you have expressed your views. Now, as I said, this is a very large subject itself, privatization. It was a holy cow not to be discussed until 5 years ago. Now it is too much being discussed without anything being done, of course. Let me first say that privatization is not necessarily the only answer for the public sector ills. Mind you, I look at privatization as an answer essentially to the government's ills. The government is the owner, shareholder in the private sector. If I own shares of Voltas or some company, 100, 200, 500 shares, and I have a very bad emergency, I need funds, I sell the shares and get the funds. Similarly, government holds the shares. Government's budgetary position is in a terrible shape. It needs the funds badly. So it should sell the shares of some company which is owned. That is the government's problem. Even if it makes no difference to the public sector undertaking. You see, if I sell 500 shares of Voltas to somebody else, Voltas management is not going to be affected by that. So it is I who am affected. I do it for my own problem. Similarly, I think I would like privatization to be looked upon as a specific medicine for the government's ills, the budget problem. That is one point I would like to mention. So, and even if it does not make a difference to the private sector, I'm sorry, to the public sector unit, I'm not saying that it will never make a difference, but I'm saying that is a relatively a secondary issue. Now, among those, but with this beginning, another point is that if you look at what are the constituents of the public sector, I gave you yesterday a list of strategic, national, social and all that form. Now, I think earlier, in one of my papers, I suggested which are the early candidates for privatization. Now, I think that in the first place, those units which have come by accident, they can be straight away sold off, because the government never had an intention of, say, nationalizing a printing press. It just came as a subsidiary of something else. So, one. Similarly, those where the units were started because there was nobody in the private sector to start those units at that time, and now the private sector has come of age, those can be considered. The candidates which are to be kept later are those which are politically sensitive. We are also to face that. Supposing now, take the case of question of banks. I am just giving an example. Not that I am not in favor of banks privatization, that is not the point. But banks were nationalized with a political purpose, whatever it was. Now, bank denationalization is going to create a lot of political turmoil. So, if that is so, best thing is to keep it out for some time. Criteria should be that you make a success of privatization experiments. There are some people in the government who I know, who have been toying and playing with this idea of privatization in such a way that you will make an experiment of privatization, show to the public that it fails, to give a bad name to privatization. Scooters India, you started with that privatization, nothing happened. It has got a bad name. Look at Scooters India, what happened? We don't want privatization. Because it was a badly handled case. Similarly, the UP, which is that, pardon? That's right. Now, cement corporation of union, where there were some people were killed and all that. Now, if this is a sort of thing that is going to happen, people say, oh, but is this for privatization? We don't want it. So, you get a bad name, and I am more concerned about it, but actually I sometimes feel that people who start like this are not really friends of privatization at all. They really want to prove that privatization is bad. They start with an effort like this, and then having got a bad name for it, then people will not stop. That is a very important. In economic policy making, it is very important what happens to the first experiment, first or second. So we should go ahead, think twice, 5 times, 10 times, but make a beginning where the experiment is bound to succeed. And that is what Mrs. Thatcher did. Initially there was a tremendous opposition to her experiments also, but she started with British Telecom, one of the obvious cases. But and a lot of homework was done, and the main point in the advisor's mind was how to make a success of this experiment, because she wanted to make there a policy in future. So that is an important point which I would like you to keep in mind. Now another point, I have taken down 2 or 3 points. If I miss some point, again ask me about it. Another point which I made was that the affluent sections will buy the shares and they will benefit, and it is really at the cost of the poor. Well, in theory, yes, but affluent sections, if people who buy the shares benefit and people who sell the shares lose, that is not the case. If I am going to sell the shares because the stock market has had these dizzy heights now, well, whoever is going to buy the shares may make a loss. He may find the judgment wrong. I may make a profit because I bought at a high price. I may make a fortune because I sell at the right price, and after I sell, prices may go down. So anyway, whether prices go down or people who sell also make a profit. And if government is selling the shares and government is getting a good price for that, that revenue which comes to the government is ultimately used for the for the people. Well, the theory is all the revenue which is for the government is used by the for the people. So that argument I would not, I am not willing to share. But since we are on the point, I must also tell you that there is a thinking in the West, in the industry. Milton Friedman himself is of that view. I had a long discussion with him and he explained that why sell the shares at all? Give them away. They should be distributed in society per citizen. Now, you can't distribute per citizen how many shares they will get. So, I have some formula for that. So, for every 100 rupees or that sort of thing, or 100 for every citizen, 1 rupee, 50 paise or whatever it is. Because after all, it belongs to the government belongs to the public. So, the shares are belonging already to the public. So, they just give up. Instead of one government president of India being one shareholder, let 85 crores of people be the shareholders. Now, it can be worked, and there are people who have worked out schemes how to do this. In other words, they don't want to sell the shares, because there is one argument there is that after all, it doesn't belong to one particular section, it belongs to the whole society, so it should be distributed among them. And the government doesn't really the main difference is the government which are selling the shares are not such a bad shape budget wise as our government is. So I have been concerned more about the bad shape of the government. That is one other point. Then you also said that you should start with consumer goods. Yes, maybe, but as I said, whether consumer goods or this, that is not the important question. I think best thing is to start with those cases where you will make a success. A final point I want to make is, you see, privatization does not only mean divesting yourself of the shares which you own. That is one part of privatization. But if you, for example, if you have reserved power generation in the public sector, and now you open it up and allow private sector to enter power generation, and if after 5 years you find 3 or 4 power generation companies in the private sector have come up and started generating power, you are already privatizing. So, because my definition, which I have introduced and which seems to have been accepted in some international circles, is this: privatization is not only divestiture. Divestiture is a part of privatization. Privatization process is that process which reduces the importance of the government and the public sector in the economic affairs of the country. And there are many ways in which the importance can be reduced. One is to de-reserve. That is what we are doing. Similarly, give away contract out services. In a big, large undertaking, laundry services, travel services, they are all departmentally arranged. At least let those be given away. I am just giving a very small example. Some significant services also parts of the whole setup can also be privatized. So there are many other ways. Similarly, allow people to build roads. There have been a good discussion about building highways by the private sector. What they call BOT, Build, Operate, Transfer. BOT principle. Allow the private sector to build the roads, operate the roads until they get the return of the need, and then when they have got the return, the roads should be transferred to the government. Build, operate and transfer. There are some other, in Europe it is very commonly done. Many roads and tunnels and bridges are built by the private sector. They charge tolls and there is an agreement that when the private sector has got so much return, as it happened in case of Thana Bridge in outside Bombay. But the Thana Bridge, they only stopped the toll. It was not the private sector. But it could be the same thing. Private sector could have constructed it. You got so much receipt, then it used to be transferred to the government. So BOT. So all these are private sector, privatization ideas. Divestiture is not the only one, right, what I am saying. So this is broadly the picture as far as which candidates should be considered first for privatization. If there is any particular point about privatization which I have escaped, you would like to say?
Like in the case of private sector, there is a need to improve on the international security. We have them on our particular role. Similarly, if the public sector is privatized and then the public sector and the city is taken by a private holder, the role of that private holder in that translation if they liquidate some part of the equity and assuming that Tata is take over 30% of the equity, what will be the role of Tata? What will be the role permitted by the government, by the Tata in the public sector? Number two would be the management itself. Ambani question. If the Ambani took over part of HFC, would they permit the bureaucratic management to come on? That's the question. Because on that hinges the issue of the performance of any of the then the other point is the intercorporate zone, various financial facilities that the public sector can. If it is privatized, it is government. Then the point that I private sector, like you rightly said, is not all good, and public sector is not all bad. There are many private sector organizations which take over companies, draw rooms, take backward area facilities, sales tax exemption, excise exemption. Then build that unit by complete and then make it a total fixed unit. By that time, they've got their money, whatever their wages are, they have received their money, that's a big deal. So, that area of danger is definitely there. Like he said, you pick up a junk, you take all the facilities to the government, you do everything, milk it right further, and then you just let the government work right. That makes money. In Japan, if the unit becomes fixed, the government takes it over from the private sector, brings it restored to health, it gives it back. Now, all these points have perhaps a wider lack of the management of an organization. The question of resource, the question of infrastructure availability, these are of course common to all. But management to management is a question. Public sector or private sector, I imagine it's good. I think it should work out there. Why not we think in terms of a public sector undertaking that is CSU for semi government bodies, that is CSU SAP, CARA, like you have private sector, you have a certain high end, whatever background. In the government, you have bureaucrats, the IAS platform, where they are trained for administration. Similarly, for business, for public sector, you have an examination under the Union Public Service. For pure public sector, semi government bodies, not merely the IAS, you can have the allied services, for instance, that is the private sector. You have a police service and to have a public sector semi-government body charter there, where you get, you train and you pick up boys who are interested in running the industry.
Yes, you have raised a couple of issues which I should have answered earlier, or should I not answer, but on which I should have expressed my views earlier. One is about this junk and profit making and loss making. Now, let me very clearly say that there is always a market for the junk also. You have ruddy, all old newspapers also you sell and somebody buys the newspapers. So for everything in this world there is a buyer. Remember this. So if you are, and now why do you sell newspapers? Because they are occupying too much space in your house. You, whatever little price, you can't get better price than that from somebody else. So you go and then sell it out. Exactly the same thing, even if the unit is making losses after losses. If you allow somebody to buy it free, he means free hands, without his hands being tied, you will get a buyer. So there the idea of the highest bidder should apply. We say, and then you must, you see, the main problem in the loss making units is that the causes or the reasons why the units make a loss is, those reasons are not removed. For example, overmanning. Government will say, no, you must not retrench any single person. Well, that is the main reason why they are making losses. So who will buy this if you can't remove, if you have, you must keep 20,000 people to do the work of 500 people? How can anybody will buy that? I will tell you a very interesting case. I was in Malaysia about 2 or 3 years ago, and there the some privatization seminar, and the Minister of Industry for Malaysia came to inaugurate it. And he said, we want to privatize this, we want to privatize that. And then he circulated something, Malaysian railways are for sale for $1. Malaysian railway, the whole Malaysian railway, you are willing to sell for $1. At coffee time, I said, excuse me, sir, I don't understand what is meant by this $1. The good Tata have to buy for $1, I will make it 50 cents. I said, what exactly? There may be, I said, there may be something in small print in this. Then he smiled and he patted me, you must not retrench anybody. That is the whole purpose, because the and the two conditions, and both are absurd, and you must not raise the rates. Now, Malaysian railway rates are so cheap, railway fares are so cheap, and they are fast, so many people, so much of overemployment, that if you can't charge more fare, higher fares, and you can't depend, it is impossible for anybody to make any profit. That is why that even after offering of $1, it has come in the Financial Times, London, that Malaysian railways offer for $1. They do take it. So, remember that if you create, and that is why I think you made that point, that the condition, the environment must be first changed. If you are keeping the same restrictive environment, then the whole purpose of privatization is lost. That is the point. But otherwise, simply because it is loss making, you don't have to worry. If you are willing to give the freedom, there will be always somebody who will be able to buy. He may close down the unit, he may demolish the factory, and he may put some other factory in it. He will look at the land value, whatever it is, his problem. And mind you, governments, by giving away something which is loss-making, in the first place, the government's budget is improved two ways. You don't have to subsidize the losses. Every year, government is subsidizing the losses. Otherwise, who bears the losses ultimately? That is one thing. And then, the unit goes in other hands, goes in other people's hands, and it becomes profitable. I happen to have written a little book on privatization. And Adam Smith, 200 years ago, talked about privatization, very, very interesting. He has said that you should, I hope I can find it. Yes, that's right. Adam Smith said in 1776, in every great monarchy in Europe, the sale of crown land, where all the land belongs to the government, belongs to the crown, the sale of crown land would produce a very large sum of money. He is asking for privatizing land. Land did not belong to the government. Government should sell off the land. That is what he is saying. It will produce a very large sum of money, which if applied to the payment of public debts, you should use that money, should be used to reduce your public debt. That is again, my view also. would deliver from mortgage a much greater revenue than any which those lands have ever afforded to the crown. The land, as it belongs to the government, doesn't give any revenue to the government. If the land is sold and the revenue is reduced to the public, used for reduction of public debt, there is much better revenue used in that. And when the crown lands have become private property, they would in the course of few years become much better improved and well cultivated. So that is again, when you hand over, when somebody buys with hard cash, he is bound to make use of that asset in some better way than the government has been able to make use of. So loss making is not a point against it at all. Of course it is a point that there is no queue of waiting outside. You see, that is why governments have imposed this condition and that condition, and now open up the door for privatization as if whole 20 industrialists are waiting outside. Nobody is waiting outside. Because they know that this is Scooters India, what you did, UP, what you did. If that sort of thing is there, nobody is going to buy. So that, but profit making undertakings also. Mrs. Thatcher has sold most of the privatization, her privatization attempts have been in profit making undertakings, and also every time she has kept a few shares with herself, that is with the government. She has never sold 100% shares. She has always sold majority shares. But what I am saying, I have been saying it, 49% in case of profit making at least can be sold without any political controversy. If ONGC 49% shares are sold, the management and control remains with the government definitely. At least you and I will buy ONGC shares, we will get some dividend. We will be able to buy. Many people like to buy public sector. We like to buy, put money in national savings, put money in bank deposits. So we will put money in public sector equity shares also. So at least there is no political controversy. The last point about management which you mentioned, if you sell off 20% shares, 25% shares, then the company will behave exactly as per Companies Act. If I have 20% shares, a package of 20% shares in my possession on the proxies, whatever rights I have as a 20% shareholder in the Companies Act, I will exercise those rights. So government cannot have separate rules. In case of a public sector, even if you have 20%, you shall not do this. That sort of thing will not be. Government must behave like a shareholder, others will also be allowed to behave like a shareholder. No, sir, whether it is Ambani or Tata makes no difference. What are your proxies? What are the proxies you are controlling is the question. That is what happens in the Companies Act. And I think that is what it must. So it must be again, I have been saying the same thing, level ground. You must have the level ground in all these economic policy making, and then I think you may get better results. Anyway, I think we should, shall we shift to our question?
Before we privatize the property, the funds are the only criteria for the private sector, the 50% of the private sector is held by the private sector. Why not offer those to the public at large? So, what is the increase in the private sector? Why don't you keep the private sector? Why don't you take Tata Company? Tata Company is about 4% of the private sector. But if you take 50% of the property, it is a private sector.
There are two points to be made in this. Financially, when IDBI holds shares, or ICICI holds shares, or banks, or unit trust, or LIC, they are not Government of India funds. So if IDBI or unit trust sells the shares, unit trust holds a large chunk of many private sector company shares, no mutual funds, that money is not government, that is your and my money. It is private sector money. So it is selling shares by unit trust does not help the government budget at all. Government is not in the picture. Excuse me, just 1 minute, please. So that is the point, very big difference there. In the case of public sector, Government of India, President of India is the registered shareholder. And when the President of India sells the shares, the revenue which you get, it comes to the government treasury. Selling shares of Tata Steel by mutual funds, not 1 rupee go to the government treasury, 1 rupee the proper cent, will not go to the government treasury. That is the.
Why did the family which owned some shares in BPM and the other family which owned a few shares in Escort go whining to government for protection against the person who are buying more shares in the open market and has acquired a greater number of shares than the two families own. And when he wanted to put these people on the board and take over the management of the company, again minority shareholding, why did these two people who were mining to government, and why did all these great proponents of privatization and all these great people who talked about the efficiency of the public sector, superiority of the marketplace, where were they when this fundamental era?
Well, are we not going a little beyond the question of public sector? I have answer to that. Don't think that I am avoiding reply to that. But I think this question is neither related to the public sector nor to privatization. So, but I will answer that if we have nothing else left. But certainly, I would have liked to have some sort of a brainstorming session one day. Actually, if you ask any questions, and I will avoid all answers. but excuse me, just one minute.
If at all the private sector would be persuaded to buy a few public sector corporations, they should be allowed to nominate their members on the board.
But to that my answer was that they should be allowed to nominate depending on the Companies Act. Has anybody else asked? Excuse me, do you want to discuss this, or do you have any questions on the public sector first? I don't mind discussing this. But do you have one? No, I think you can first finish the public sector part and then come back to this very interesting question. You are talking about public sector? Yes, of course, Vishnu. So only 20 minutes left.
I wanted to make a very big submission, and maybe there could be one function in the submission. Whatever you are very kindly telling us, one is things behind the scenes. Government of India debarred any government belonging to IAS or whatever subject from even applying for the government of India unless he resigned from his trust. And this resignation was not just published on the business to the left, it is accepted by the people. I think after the administration executed the suspension of the they only need to consider that amongst other candidates in responsible advertisement in the newspaper or a vote in the public sector. This order is very clear. So there could not be any misconception that the Constitution of the Constitution would go flat in the case to talk about the second point is, directing out of the product, I know of the situation as of last year. More than 350 chairmen and chairmen from American directors are very negative in the public sector industry. Because from private sector, people are not continuing to get for various reasons to join the public sector. The government is not getting any money from the government, not from public sector, it is being accepted. Jobs, independent production, and the location, they are in the now, one or two examples, like Mr. Rati Bhagav, who is in the India of Rati Bhagav, he is very popular. In the case of the Asian Mark, he is in the India of Rati Bhagav. Second point to pay attention to was that in my own career, in the state public sector administration, the doctor is also here. I have come very close to the administration and the project director of the public sector industry. What I have seen that our approach to public sector project is first we write down the financial plan. All CDMs, all partners are looking to financial plan. And this financial plan is discussed same year, right up to the after this financial planning is over, that is the GDP ratio and the next very detailed discussion becomes about township plan. What will be the location of that project? What will be the size of that town? Whether it be Makari or Life or Social Department, Plan and Family Development, all these departments. After finalizing this township planning and this township has come down, then a discussion begins about the technical collaboration. Whether the diameter is in the US or the USA or the other. If one planning which is neglected practically till the end, absolute time end, is the material itself. The kind of material, I think that you know, is two kinds. Another kind of material is that licensing is accepted raw material for producing the material. The material benefit, according to IMR, in a crop, anywhere in the CDM part, any stock, will show that this section is a material planning. And this is just a normal for the life of the material. Material planning is only used for all of them. Now, to conclude this subject, my recent experience in India and India for relations, I, out of the university, in the India professional project, the taking of the point, of course, I not even understand of my idea about this case. And I found exactly from the professional project, which is now having an overrun of 10% growth, all of this is done. But if I think when you get our situation, what guides the government of India to set up deficits 146 or 146 public sector undertaking in India? If you have come across this situation.
No, I don't think there is any criteria. First, let me answer briefly the last question and then make an observation on the earlier one. I don't think that there is any criteria in that sense, apart from the simple fact that there is the industrial policy resolution, which says that public sector, certain industries are reserved, in some other industries, another schedule, public sector will take increasing part, but private sector may also be allowed. And the third part, which is largely left to the public private sector, but public sector is not prevented from entering, which really means that public sector can enter into anything. And then there is every ministry under its own administrative control, whatever industries come in that, they propose plan projects to the planning commission. And once the planning commission approves them and introduces in one plan, then the plans, the projects are not implemented, but at least you start working on that. Otherwise, there is no criteria at all. Now, with the new industrial industrial policy, there will be some restriction on it. I mean, now I think it looks to me from reading of this that the government will be considering, do we really need to do this? Is nobody else willing to do this? And that sort of question perhaps internally they may be asking. Again, it depends, subject to some vested powerful interests and all that other stuff. They will always find some cases going through, some cases getting stuck and all that. Anyway, that is one. I was greatly interested in your first observation about the fact that since 1981, there is a rule that public sector, Government of India officers will not become on deputation or on foreign service, as they say, will not become parts of public sector units. I was not aware of it. And does it mean, I want to know from this August gathering, particularly public sector representatives, does it mean that at present, there is nobody from the Government of India on deputation working in public sector units?
That is, government servants, before they want to, if they want to themselves to apply,
they have to resign and go to that superior state. The other thing is that you can't go on ventilator. What you can do is, what is allowed is that in respect of certain public sector undertaking, the government servant is offered, or you can offer his services. But even there, it is a one-time thing. He doesn't have to keep a scandal, as Mr. Kohli talked about, that having resigned, he might not be selected. In these cases, if he is selected and he joins, he is deemed to have retired. His retirement benefits are paid long term, as Mr. Kohli was saying, one time, nine times. He cannot come back to work in any case. Only in respect of a few public sector organizations, such as Food Corporation of India, Nuclear Power Corporation, and half a dozen such organizations, a special dispensation allows government servants who have gone there to be on this. That is probably, I think, not more than enough.
No, excuse me, but let me understand this. Say you said Food Corporation and Nuclear Power Corporation. You gave two examples. Now, does it mean that the Nuclear Power Corporation constitution provides for that?
No.
As a special case, when Mr. A is appointed on the Nuclear Power.
Taking into account the nature of duties which are performed by the nature of functions to be discharged by the Food Corporation of India or Nuclear Power Corporation.
Yeah.
The government has given this kind of an exemption from the general order to prohibit
government. Okay. So, when the government appoints Mr. A as a Food Corporation chairman or member or whatever it is, the government says that, well, we know that these are the normal practices, but in view of special circumstances, whatever the government knows and the person knows, we are appointing you on this on a sort of specified term, isn't it? So, there are some honorable exceptions. 8, 10, whatever they are. Excuse me, I am not concerned about 6 or 10 or 8, but there are a few exceptions, less than 12, less than 5, but otherwise, I take it from this gathering that there is no case, apart from this half a dozen restrictions, there is no case of a government servant going and occupying a public sector unit's post full time. Where he has a choice of coming back to his post.
Yes,
I am talking about central public. Yeah.
And secondly, there could be a number of people who have gone.
If they resign and go, and then they become the swim or as a prosper with that, that's all right. That is not a problem. You are talking about the states. Let us not carry on this discussion too long. Mr. Ghosh, excuse me. So if the central government has taken the decision, I am very glad, and I don't have to make that point next time in my speech. But I can only make it as far as the state governments are concerned, because apparently there's no uniformity in this, and there are some honorable exceptions, as you said, in central government, but that is all right. If it is half a dozen, 8, 10, it doesn't matter at all. But the general practice, established practice, is that either government of India or public sector, not one foot here and one foot there, isn't it? Okay. That I'm glad to have been informed about that. Yes. No, excuse me. Pardon?
They go 50 kilometers south every day.
No, but the, no, the, but that. Mr. Excuse me. I think we'll close this particular question, and it only adds to my first point which I made yesterday, that public sector is a motley crowd. Think of anything and public sector has an example. So think of poor planning, public sector has an example. Think of housing complex, think of no housing, there's an example in public sector also. So think of anything, there's an example. That is what I was saying, and you add to my point for my next speech. Okay.
My question is on the efficiency of the public sector. The answer is mentioned after the overmanning in the previous India. But the reform that you mentioned, that reform, the efficiency and overmanning in public sector will come into this. And I have no doubt about that in the public sector. And our laws provide that you can't even hire a helper in the public sector and the government sector also. Should the government not think that we should prove the manpower and make these into more efficient? Because what is happening now, you see, there are efficient people in the public sector. So there are less efficient people therefore going to sit in there. So the overall efficiency is going down much faster. And I am not really seeing any reforms proposed by the politicians or the government. That we must remove the manpower, make it more efficient. I am not saying that you put the people on the street. You divert them into something else. So this aspect of pruning the manpower in the public sector and also in the urban sector hasn't really given much of a thought.
Any comments on this? In effect, you are saying is there must be some provision. The efficiency need not be, if the efficiency average level has gone down, it need not be only because there are too many people employed. It can be many other factors also, but this is one factor. I appreciate so, but see, the general feature that the public sector efficiency seems to be low generally. There are exceptions again, but the reason for the low efficiency is not only the fact that there are overmanned. There may be some other factors also which have resulted in lower efficiency. Isn't it? Maybe the technology or the capital equipment is outdated, or the autonomy is not there, or all sorts of factors can be there. Overmining is one of the factors, isn't it? And what do you accept it, or you think that
it's a serious factor?
Of course, it is a very serious factor, no doubt about that. I myself mentioned it at great length yesterday. So the question is, what should be done about it? Any
I have more of the same question you were talking yesterday. And some causes, some shortcomings through the debt and interest debt and over many can be understood. But why does the project get delayed? What is the cause of that delay? And what is the cause of inefficiency? That cannot be explained. Because once whether it's the private sector or public sector, these things, what would the reason? Is there no willpower among the people to do this job? What is the government of?
I think many of you who are from the public sector should know the answer for that. But anyway, again, you see, there is a, you cannot generalize that this is the one reason why projects get delayed. The Program Implementation Ministry's report, which gives the whole data about delays, there is a whole discussion about delays there. Various factors have been given. And there are different factors for different, and sometimes labor trouble, initially. Sometimes, you are, as Mr. Ghosh was saying, that you start first, you first have the financial planning, then you start looking for agreements, then you get the start get looking about land and all that sort of thing. Everything, you see, suppose if there will be land trouble, I mean, there will be land dispute, and somebody goes to the court, and then that dispute remains, and for 2 years nothing happens. Now, all these things, I mean, I'm not saying again that happens everywhere, but any number of factors are there. But the main factor is that there is no drive
You see, in a private sector, the entrepreneur who is concerned, he knows that every day's delay means so much to his pocket. There is nobody to feel that way in the public sector.
Sorry,
sir.
Do we have so much jobs theory?
Pardon?
Do we have so much jobs theory in
the public sector? Job security. We have too much, you are asking whether there is too much job security. So, I think that perhaps yes, perhaps you are right. To some extent, again, the job security has its value, but too much job security to some extent is there, because after all, nothing can happen to you. As a matter of fact, the rule, I mean, the way in which public sector server, with everybody sitting here being exception, I have myself been in the public sector of government of India for 12-13 years. The general approach is that my bosses have been also, don't make a mistake. That is the approach. Don't make sure that you are not flouting any rules. Even if the project gets delayed, doesn't matter, but make sure that you are within the minimum tenders, this thing, that thing, make sure about all these. But then you will be protected. If you try to expedite the project by doing a little here or there, even if you are not doing anything personally for yourself, one day you may get in trouble. That approach seems to be there. Even now it seems to be there. So, but in the private sector, the approach is opposite. They don't mind if you make two mistakes. If you do 8 good things there, you are judged by the good things that you do. Forget the mistakes. In public sector, you are judged by the mistakes which you make. The good thing which you do are forgotten. I mean, I can clear up. Well, I myself, as I said, work in government and I work in data, so I know the difference. So, I think that may be causing the project delays and lower efficiency. The job security, I think, is too much of job security is bad. Now, you must decide when do you want to, whether you have any other questions to ask. I am at your disposal as long as you want, but you look after your team. 3:15. It is 3:10. Well, you decide. You want him to say. You want him to say, make his observations.
One is, I feel that concept is future. I think from now on, the jobs will be for not more than 15 years. Preferably, they should be contracts of 5 years. But you know, I know CSIR has this kind of scheme, but it will never happen. Why I am saying that the jobs will be for 15 years? This is, and then you can give this life to liberalize pensionary or other benefits. Because what will happen is that if the chap knows that he is going to be out of this job at the age of 35 or 40, he will ensure that he will retain some skills that he does not become obsolete. And subsequently, he will either set up some small venture on his own or try a fine job. For the people who are already existing and are considered as dead work.
Will you please, I can't hear what Mr. Bhatia is. Would you kindly keep quiet, please?
And are already considered as dead work. I think a kind of scheme whereby you have a golden handshake for which is complex. I'm sure it's
a 15-year limited job, that is his proposal. That will improve the public sector efficiency. Do you, what is, any comment?
All the people came here that we can do a manual job, fine, and the
this is for managers also, by the way.
This is all very negative announcement.
You mostly for managers.
Now, you see, as Siva and Sakit, Sakit, and then both of you. Now, as far as job security is concerned, I am in the private sector. I have as much job security, in fact, more. And that will see AWC or something like that. It's a scope for review. I mean, somebody found you a dead body, they can be removed. But in actual practice, I don't think anybody can ever give me. Because just because it's a government, nobody's business, why has the school for all these people for the internet, ask anybody. There are people, there are so many people, just because you are good enough, you are identifying me, but so many people just don't want to bother to identify. So why? These people actually get taken. So in our society, I think, and once somebody has money,
Okay, I think we should conclude this discussion now. But in conclusion, I would like to make two observations, general observations, which I didn't make yesterday. One is that after all, human beings are the same human beings everywhere. I don't think one can generalize and say that in public sector people are like that and public, the people are the same. You see, they get adjusted to the culture which they stay around them. The man at 25 gets appointed at public sector, another two brothers brought the same family, one may get, see, they, both of them get adjusted to the environment in which they have to live and in which they think they will prosper or they will do better. Or they, if they don't feel they can adjust, they get out of it and go somewhere else where they can fit. So, human beings are the same, and I don't think there's any question of efficiency in the public sector being, people in public sector being less efficient or people in private sector being more efficient. It is the system which is there. Now, system of, and then why the system is what it is another matter. There's a very large question. That is one. And second point which I generally wanted to make is that whatever happens to all these pro-privatization people, even if they decide to privatize so many things, as Mr. Thatcher did, for a long, long time to come, at least for next 15 years, public sector, there is going to be a large and significant public sector in India, after all the privatization which you have done. Because here there are, it is very easy to say that privatize that, but even in case of Mrs. Thatcher, she has privatized so many major industries, still in Britain, you can't say that everything is privatized. There is a long way to go. I don't know whether even British society is prepared for that, to privatize everything as some people call it. So, for a long time to come, even in the event of divestiture of several major units, even in the event of private sector being, all areas being opened up to the private sector, which were restricted, which are out of bounds for the private sector, for the next 15 years at least, 10, 15 or perhaps 20 years, I clearly see that public sector will still continue to occupy, in terms of assets, in terms of employment, in terms of investment, a significant share in Indian society, in Indian economy. I can clearly see that. What you can do about it is something has got to be done about it at all, or this is to be accepted with good humor or not is another matter. But I don't think there is any question of private public sector being finished or private public sector being completely private, and that will just not happen for a long time to come.
Okay, we should stop now for a very short break.
Yes.
On a series of three or four issues which I consider important but which can't be fitted into one particular subject as such. And the first issue which is very important and which we all talk about, this whole question of economic progress. And ultimately, some people would, I suppose we all agree that the whole object of our life is to become more happy. The contribution of the economist generally looks at the things, how is everybody better off? That means his income is increasing. The idea is that if this is equivalent to economic welfare, as the economists say. And if a man is economically, his economic welfare is better, then to that extent his total welfare is better. It is possible to argue that a rich man is not necessarily the happiest man. This is well beyond the subject of economics, how to make a rich man happy. But generally the economist's limited view is to try to make everybody better off. So that if he is better off, he has a choice or he has the purchasing power in his command to make use of it in any way that he wants, and that is an instrument towards happiness, that is welfare rather. Now, so we look at all these whole phenomenon, economists, from the point of view of making each one of us or making the country as a whole better off than today, better as compared to other countries, better position. That is the first point which we must appreciate. Now, how do you decide whether you are better off, whether I am better off than Mr. Bhatia or Mr. Bhatia is better off than so and so? Again, the economist generally assumes that if my income in any given particular year is larger than Mr. Bhatia's income, I am better off. I mean, by the way, income means family. Let us take a family. We really talk about per capita, per head income. My income is larger, then I am better off. Now, I am saying all this because at every stage there are disputes. Many people don't agree with it. So, I am saying that, well, we talk about GNP and all that. The whole object of economic planning, and that is the basic idea, is to improve the per capita GNP. Now, what is meant by per capita GNP? I am coming to trying to explain. My personal income is not only the income which I receive from my salary or from my other sources of income. And mind you, the income is also includes the illegal black money income. So, in the total GNP, which is there is an overlapping. Well, we need not go into that complication. But let us look at GNP as we see. Plus, I get certain benefits from society. I get a road to use. I didn't construct the road. I don't pay for it, but I get it because through my taxes, etc. So, I get certain goods and services, plus I use of some goods and services, plus I get an income. Now, that goods and services which I don't actually earn anything from that or spend anything from that, I seem to get free. But again, the economist said there is no such thing as a free lunch. When I am using the road and I am not paying for it, doesn't mean that it is free. I have paid for it or somebody has paid for it. So, all these, whatever I get in a month or get in a year, is called income. And the total nation's income is divided by the number of people in the country, and that is called the per capita income. My income, your income, government's income, a particular company's income, all these are incomes in society. All these incomes are added to make the gross national income, it is called gross national product or national income. Now again, I must tell you, national income and national product. Gross national product and net national product. There are differences. Again, let us not go into that because that will be too complicated and not necessary. So, we really talk about GNP, gross national product. It is this, the addition of what everybody in the society has produced. Now, there is a difference between the gross domestic product and the gross national product, which I should explain in 1 minute, though it is not critical. National product is whatever we produced in the country. Out of that, whatever we export is domestic, thus whatever is exported is deducted from that. Whatever is imported is added to that. So, that becomes gross national product. Domestic product means we don't deduct the exports, don't add the imports. Whatever is produced in the country is gross domestic product. Anyway, this is just in case you see the term GDP, GNP, this is what it really means. Gross domestic product, gross national product. So, all the things which are produced, the value in terms of money, now how much am I producing, or what is the value of production is the price. So, whatever I get for my services is the salary. So, my work is valued at my salary. Everybody's work service is valued at the money which he gets for doing that service. There again people say that this is not right. Some people are very poorly paid, some people are getting all that. So, but in economics, the value of your work is equal to the money which you get for the service or the work which you do or the goods which you sell. So, that is, so therefore, we get the GNP divided by population and then we get a per capita GNP. Now, today, the per capita GNP may be say 3000 rupees. Tomorrow means say 1991-92. I am assuming that whatever it is assumed, let us assume that it is 3000 rupees. In 92-93, you will find that it has become 4000 rupees. I am just explaining. Does it mean that everybody is better off to the extent of 3000 to 4000, about 30%? Not necessarily. Because the 4000 rupees in the 1992-93
is at those prices. Now, if with my salary today, I am able to buy certain goods and services. I get 5,000 rupees, I pay some taxes on that, whatever remains. I pay house rent, I buy food grains, I buy this, I buy that, and that sort of thing. So, this is the basket of goods and services which I am able to get with my salary. If prices of all these things on an average, some things may go up more, some things may go less, prices may go down. But if you find that to buy the same basket of goods and currency, goods and services next year, it is going to cost me not 3,000 but 3,600 or 3,600 rupees. I am just giving an example. Then my saying that I am getting 4,000 rupees, I am not better off to the extent from 3,000 to 6 or 4,000. But I am better off only to the from the extent of 3,600 to 4,000. How much more, how to what extent I can improve the basket, what extent I can make my basket of goods and services which I am able to use bigger and bigger. That is how I become better off and better off. So that is the question which you are left. And therefore you must always consider the per capita GNP in real terms. So adjusting for inflation. So that is, therefore, ultimately, a society's level, or is the society economically progressing or not, economists generally see by looking at the per capita GNP in real terms. If prices rise by 10% and the per capita GNP so and so, you reduce that by 10% first to make it comparable with the last year's GNP, per capita GNP. And then you say that this is the GNP which I must earn to maintain my last year's standard of living. Am I earning more than that? If to the extent that I am earning more than that, my standard of living has improved or I am better off. Now that is a general, therefore the per capita GNP in real terms is accepted as a measure of economic progress by economists. And that is in all countries. So that much, I think we must start off with that particular fact. Now having started that fact, now let me give you some figures which are very interesting. They are international figures, international comparisons. And these again are figures are taken from this favorite book of mine called Japan 1991, International Comparisons. The GNP, I am giving you two figures, the total national product and the per capita in different countries in one given year, 1987 I think. In USA, the GNP was $4,880 billion. By the way, billion is 1,000 million or 100 crores or abj. It is the same. Abj is equal to 100 crores is equal to billion, B for Bombay, not million, M for Madras. That is billion. So, $4,880 billion was the US income. Total country's income divided by the number of people, and the per capita income was $19,800. As compared to that, India in that year, the total national product was $255 billion as against 4,800 in case of USA, and therefore our per capita income was $326. Where the USA per capita income is 19,800 and ours is $326. Now I am giving you the richest country in the world. Now richest again in the definition of per capita GNP is Switzerland. And in Switzerland, the total national product was only $184 billion. And in India, it is 255. So the national product of India is much better off than Switzerland. But Switzerland is a small country and small population. So the per capita is $28,000 as against $19,000 for USA. Japan also is richer than USA with $23,000 per capita. And Australia, whose national income is roughly equal to the Indian national income, namely 260 and ours is 255. But the Australian per capita national income is $16,000 and ours is 300. So these are the sort of figures which give you some idea about it. But having given you the figures, I must immediately point out that these figures are very, very treacherous. These are wrong. These are wrong ways of comparing the economic welfare of different countries. And I will come to that in a moment. Now the drawback, you see, before I come to the drawbacks of the international comparisons, I must also point out to you the drawbacks of the whole idea of JP and internal company. One reason. Now, a man who earns $1,000 in USA and $1,000 is equal to 26,000 rupees. The $1,000 in USA, he is not as well off as a man who has 26,000 rupees in India. And if he lives in India, and a man who lives in India. Take an extreme case. Take $1. What can you do with $1 in USA? You can do much better with 26 rupees in India. That is a fact. Therefore, it is not right to make these general comparisons and by reducing all the figures to a common currency like US dollars, which is very commonly done. All publications, World Bank, everybody does that. But this is the wrong way of doing that. Because you have to consider what is the purchasing power of your currency. And Indian rupees purchasing power, 26 rupees purchasing power is much more than the US dollar one purchasing power. Now let me put it like let me put it in this particular way. Imagine a man, if you are a man, you are being given 1,000 rupees and you are flown in the sky. And you are given a choice that with that $1,000 in your pocket, you will be allowed to land in any country in the world and then convert that $1,000 in the local currency. Where will you be better off? I think probably you will be better off in India than in any other country. This is a very interesting thing, because with 26,000 rupees in your pocket, you can live. I mean, you are keep your body and soul together, buy some bare necessities, stay in a small hut, take a bus ride or whatever it is. With that $1,000, you can't do anything like that in USA. For various other reasons. I mean, let us not go into the reasons. So this is a very, very peculiar way of looking at it. But this is, if you are sent in a parachute, you are given a choice of land in any country, then probably you will do better off. So the purchasing power of the Indian rupee is much more than the exchange rate suggests. Now, some people have done research also on this. What is the purchasing power parity of the different currencies? Now, take the simple case. We go to a small, I don't know about Bangalore, but in Bombay, a small restaurant, with hundreds and hundreds and thousands of people, clerks and sepoys, who have their midday meal, what we call a rice plate, is about 9 rupees. Now, 9 rupees is 30 cents. Can you get anything in USA for 30 cents? You get a midday meal in India. You get a bus ride. I'm taking an extreme example which never applies to me. How much does haircut cost in USA? $15. And plus you have to give a tip for that. And here for 12 or 13 rupees I go into an air conditioned saloon. Of course, the barber has a big problem about me. But with 12 or 13 rupees in an air conditioned saloon I have a haircut. In $15, what does a taxi cost? You see everywhere, then you will find that the same dollar converted into rupees, it goes much better, much longer in India than in almost any other country. So that is a point also therefore we should not say that, well, how can we ever catch up with USA? I'm not saying that we should not try to catch up with USA, but I'm trying to explain to you that we must appreciate these facts in our mind. Another point is the relation between GNP and happiness. And mind you, I need not give you names, but some people whom I respect very much, they are, one of them is no more, is a very high grade industrialist and a very keen photographer. He used to move about in Lonawala, Khandala area and take photographs. Once he was showing me photographs of the aboriginal women, Adivasi women, men, playing, dancing, such radiant smile on their face. And he asked me, Pensey, are you right? Do you think you are right in trying to improve the GNP of everyone? Will that smile remain on their face when you tell them in the first place that you are unhappy, you, all the politicians will say that, look, you are unhappy, you, I want to improve your conditions. Then make them unhappy and then try to put more and more money into their pocket, and they still, the smile is gone forever. Does the smile or happiness depend on the money in your pocket? But that is, as I said right in the beginning, it is a basic question. I have no answer to that. As I have an answer to that, may view on it as an individual citizen. But as an economist, my function is to see how everybody has more money in his pocket than today. Tomorrow, more money in pocket than today. That is the whole objective of that. So, happiness is a different thing. So, and same in USA is the richest country and Switzerland is the richest country. Are those people in so many times more happy than an average Indian is a question. And how do you decide who is more happy? These are very, very philosophical questions. I dare not even touch them, but I just want to raise them for your consideration. And another point is that why does the GNP, does it show an economic welfare at least? Is a doubt. And now there is an increasing body of people who feel that the GNP does not tell the story. It is the social development which we must consider, and therefore look at some social indicators or indicators of social development or social development indicators. And people are coming around to this view, and I very much share that view, is this, that rather than the per capita GNP, another concept called U5MR is a better criteria of deciding who is better off. And U5MR means under 5 mortality rate. Under 5 mortality rate. And see, the UNICEF started with this concept of U5MR. And then they, let me see where it is. See, in my own book, I can't find the tables which I have used. Levels of living, yes. Child mortality rate and GNP per capita. So actually, when I started looking at it, I was so impressed by this fact that we introduced in this book a table comparing the GNP per capita and the U5MR rate for different countries and see what is the result. Now, I will first read out the note to that which is prepared by UNICEF. UNICEF considers under 5 mortality rate, that is the annual number of deaths of children under 5 years of age per 1000 live births, as the best single social indicator of development and well-being, more than the GNP per capita. UNICEF has considered this because the U5MR reflects U5MR under 5 mortality rate. This indicator reflects income, nutrition, health care and basic education all in one. Because after all, GNP, you increase the purchasing power for what? For better longevity, for better education, for better life. Now, if your nutrition is better, education is better, your incomes are better, all these get reflected automatically in the under 5 mortality rate. Countries which are better off, the under 5 mortality rate goes down and down. Not necessarily proportionately with the incomes, because if that were so, there is no point in looking for another indicator. Mind you, this is the difference. Countries in this table are in descending, I organize them in descending order of U5MR and increasing order of GNP. Now, the interesting point about this is, let us see this, USA. USA, U5MR is 13. That means 13 children for every 1000 live births die before they become 5. 13 per 1000. In case of India, it is 152. Alright. So they have made a list of 131 countries and ranked the countries. If the U5MR rate is lowest, that means your social development is best among the 131 countries. If the rate is highest, the social development is the least. Same countries also rank in terms of per capita GNP. If the per capita GNP is the highest and that is equivalent to the lowest U5MR. That means the two indices are moving together, but it does not happen. Now, I will give you the two or three instances of this. Sweden is a country where the U5MR is the lowest in the world. It is 7. As against USA, it is, USA I told you 13. That means in Sweden, only 7 children per 1000 live births die before they are 5. In India, as I told you, and the worst figure is Mozambique, where the 295 children die before they are 5 out of 1000 births. So that is, actually that is out, I have selected only about 25 countries out of 131, and Mozambique's ranking is 3 in U5MR. That means there are 2 countries worse than this also. I have not included in that. But, so this is the U5MR ranking, but if you look at the GNP ranking, look at the USA. USA, the ranking in U5MR was 110. That means there are 20 countries which are better off from the social indicator than USA. But in the per capita income, it is only one country which at that time it was only one country. Now you can see Japan and Switzerland both. There is only one country which is better off in terms of per capita GNP. Sweden, as compared to Sweden, there are 7 countries which are better off in per capita GNP, but no country which is better off in social indicator of this U5MR. So if your ultimate objective is that the society should develop socially, this social indicator reflects, is built into it. So it is built into it, the influence of all other important factors, including GNP. That is the theory. And a lot of people have done a lot of work, and they are coming around to start using this as a criteria for progress, even for economic progress. I, for one, share this view, and therefore I would suggest to you that in future, try to look at not only the GNP per capita, but try to look at how we are improving, and India, by the way, is better off. I should have told that. India is better off from the social indicator point of view. That means its ranking is much better off in U5MR than it is in per capita GNP. And that is, you see, the GNP, as I told you, doesn't, international comparisons are not valid. But U5MR, since they are in real terms, the international comparisons become more valid. So that is, I think, a point which I would like you to be left with. But if you take, African countries, but doesn't matter. But I mean, it is not necessary that every African country must perform worse than us. But the facts are here. But for whatever it is, I will show you. Levels of living. I wanted India. Our ranking is 39. That means there are out of 91 countries which are better off in the U5MR. But our ranking in per capita income is only 20. That means 110 countries are better off in GNP per capita GNP than us. But only 90 countries are better off in U5MR than India. So Indian ranking if you take these two indicators, we are little better off in the League of Nations under the criteria of U5MR rather than per capita GNP. You are most welcome to look at. Actually, I have got another paper which I forgot to bring with me here. These are figures for 1986, and I have got one more year's figure, later year's figure, which I got somewhere else. I will show you. But the ranking is more or less the same. And I expect that in the 10 to 15 years to come, our relative ranking will improve even further in the U5MR, simply because of various other factors, because of the purchasing power of the rupee is an important consideration in that. Now, that is about the criteria. You wanted Cuba. I don't know whether I got them here. No, Cuba, I haven't got him. Well, I only selected 25 countries for the purpose. Yes? Okay. So now, I'm afraid we are very much behind this. Now, that much about, first I said that I therefore feel I have great reservations about using the per capita GNP as a criteria of progress. But having said that, and since generally it is used, in the subsequent discussion, if I continue to use that, please forgive me. But I explained my limited view. Now, I will tell you, there are some people who say, we must catch up with the USA. Now, if you are talking about per capita national income, I don't see any chance of our ever catching up with the USA in my life, certainly, maybe in your life, yes. Now, take the simple arithmetic. The USA is $20,000 per capita, and we are $300 today. And USA also is growing. It is not stopped at $20,000. It is increasing its per capita income every year. But even assume it is stopped, from 300 to move to 20,000, what growth rate, compound growth rate is required for the next 20 years? Try to work out on one of your calculators. You will find that the growth rate requires about 18 to 19% in real terms for 20, 30 years to achieve that. And mind you, in the meanwhile, USA would have gone further. So it is going, and we have barely achieved 5.5% last 10 years. For 30 years, we were struggling with 3.5%. So it is, of course, then you can say, is it worth catching up? That is a different question. That is a philosophical question. But if you want to catch up, but don't think of that all that sort of thing. It is not going to happen, definitely not in my lifetime. Now, another way of looking at it is, as Mr. J.R.D. Tata put forward about 10 years ago, when he was given the doctorate of the Bombay University, he gave a speech. And he looked at 50 years ahead. See, he said 50 years behind and 50 years ahead. 50 years behind, what happened and what does he see India happening to India in 50 years ahead? That was in about 10 years ago. And he walked out and he showed that from 1980 to 50 years, that is 2030, in that year, if we want to achieve half of the average of Europe's standard of living today, that means in 1980. See, Europe is itself a motley crowd. There is a Sweden in one case and Spain and Italy in another. But take the average of that. And European average is less than half of USA. But whatever that is, so take Europe's average per capita national income in 1980. Take our per capita national income in 1980. And assume that we want to achieve half of Europe's standard of living in 1980, and we want to achieve it by the year 2030, 50 years hence. That can be done if we control our population to 1 billion, and maintain a growth rate of 7% per annum for 50 years. Now, we have already lost for the last 10 years. Our growth rate has not been 7%, we are only 5.5%. So we have to catch up with that again. And our population, there is no chance of it being contained at 1 billion. Already, this book gives a projection of India's population at 1040 million by the turn of the century. Already. And then by the year 2030, it will be much more. So even that is good. And there, Mr. Chattata said that at least that is necessary for India. So that we can be rest assured that all our citizens are free from hunger, free from, and get the basic needs provided. So see what is the very, very difficult task ahead of us if you look at it from the per capita, and look at the GNP as a per capita indicator. Well, that much about this whole idea of poverty, GNP and happiness and all that. Let me go to the second subject, namely population. In population, you see, we are all the time talking about population being a big problem. That population has been a short-term problem in the world. All these years, 300 years ago, there was no population problem in any country.
Lot of children were being born, lot of people were dying, population was more or less stationary.
So this stationary population is right from 10,000 BC until 200 or 300 years ago. Stationary population, practically stationary population. Then the health standards improved, the death rate started falling and whatever it is. So population problem was created in many countries, which is right now with us. But in most developed countries, the population problem is over. Because again, the death rates have come. Formerly there was no population problem because the death rate was high, birth rate was high, difference was nil. Now there is no population problem in the developed world because the death rate is low, birth rate is low, no growth. But there's a big difference. Death rate high and birth rate high, and death rate low and birth rate low. Result may be the same, but the structure is totally different. Now, in between a stage comes when the death rate starts falling and the birth rate does not fall, and there So this is really the stark realities of the population. So this is a point, and mind you, this is not today's subject, but I one day want to write a little book on the problems of the 20th century, or problems of our generations like this. There are many other problems which are never known in world history. Inflation. Nobody ever knew what inflation was until 100 years ago. The Shivaji's day, Akbar's days, and in British, there was no inflation. So inflation, black money, energy is exactly like this. 200 years ago, people lived without energy, without crude oil, without coal. 300-400 years practically without coal. 200 years ago without any oil. And after another 100 years ago, when all the oil is exhausted, again people are going to live without oil. So this 300-400 years ago, mind you, 1 million or more, there has been human life on earth. But people have lived without oil. But just for 200-300 years, this sort of graph explains what we are in the midst of. Anyway, let me not digress. Coming back to population, we are in the midst of that population explosion, and the developing world and India is particularly in that at right now. The developed world, the problem is already over, and Japan 99, there's a table which shows you how the developed world has already passed that problem. Now, in India, if we have to control population, we can't do anything about death rate. We should be happy that death rate is going down. And our death rate is about 13 or 14, and approximately, and we want it to go down, but it was at one time about 35. So 35 to 14 is a great progress that we have achieved, but in while making that progress, we created a problem that we published, because the birth rate didn't go down. Now, birth rates are very sticky. It is very difficult to bring down the birth rate. Death rates can be brought down by better health, better education, and all that. Birth rates can be brought down later. In all over the world again, we have said that people have made these studies and see when do birth rates start coming down. They do definitely start coming down, but with a considerable time lag after the death rates start coming down. Now, they start coming down with better education, better practices of family planning, better female education, and all these various other factors which have been identified now. But we have not achieved all those factors, so it will take time. But another finding is that once the birth rate starts falling down, it always continues to fall down. It takes a long time before it starts falling down, but once it starts falling down, it falls down rapidly. Now, it is very interesting in India that from 1920 to 1970, or 70s, and up to 1980 census, the birth rate fell by only 5 points, not percent. It fell from 41 per thousand to 36 per thousand. 5 points fall in 50 years. The next 5 point fall came in 10 years, in the 80s. And now the birth rate is 32, and the death rate is 13. Therefore, the net growth is 2 or 20 or 2 per 100, 2%. So the if we managed in 10 years what took us 50 years to achieve earlier. And already in the last 3 or 4 years, from 36 it has gone down to 32. So it seems to be going down at the rate of 1 point per year. Very close. Now it may not. So about 8 or 9 percentage points in the 1990s. So we are clearly on the move towards. We are clearly moving in the right direction. But it is too early. Therefore, I have been saying yesterday, I mentioned to you earlier on the first day that I don't put population as the first number one problem, because it is not something which can you can do today in a democratic world, in a democratic society. But we seem to be seeing the end of the tunnel. We are way beyond. But at least the turns within the tunnel are there, and we see at the end that there is some light, because the birth rate has started falling. Now, look at some one or two other points also. In Japan, for example, and I am giving, in Japan in 1949, Japan was more or less in the position that we are today. The birth rate was 33 and the death rate was 12. India, today the birth rate is 33, the death rate is 14. But in Japan in 1949 to 1969, within 20 years, the birth rate came down from 33 to 18. In 20 years, 15 percentage points. And that is what I was telling you. It looks that in our case also it has started going down by 1 percentage point almost a year. So if we also may be able to manage to bring it down to 18, 14 and all that sort of thing by the year 2010. Maybe, I don't know. But that is the point. So it takes a long time for birth rate to go down, but once it goes down, it generally keeps on going down. And in India, I feel a little hopeful, because the birth rate has started falling. Now, having given hope to you, I must also give a warning to you, that even if the day comes, when the day comes, they say 2010, when the day comes that the birth rate and the death rate is equal, assume that, in 2010, at the low rate, but it is equal. So the population growth has stopped. The population growth rate has stopped. It will take 45 years after that to stop the population numbers. I mean, this is something which is interesting. Again, it is very clear, but I want you to appreciate it. Now, it is like this. Even if the number of children born in 2010 and number of children, birth and death rates are balanced, so the population is zero growth rate on that day, it doesn't mean the actual numbers will remain the same after that. Because the number of children which were born in 2009 were more than the number of children born in 2008. And 2008, the number of children born were more in 2007. Like this, you go backwards. So the number of female children which will come to the fertile age when they are born in 2009 will seem they are more. The female completes its fertility cycle at the age of 45. When a woman is 45, then she becomes infertile.